from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning in our opening hour, world leaders are meeting in New York today for the United Nations Climate Summit. Forum will discuss different approaches to combating climate change, including severe reductions in energy consumption, technological solutions, and ramping up renewable energy production. Where does the world stand in the fight against climate change, and what should be done next? Join us for Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. With greenhouse gas levels at an all-time high, world leaders are meeting today in a one-day climate summit at the United Nations in New York City. More than 120 world leaders, including President Obama, were invited and asked to bring bold ideas and slow the rise in the planet's temperatures. This opening Forum hour, we want to discuss the summit and the ongoing battle against global climate change. And we're going to go first to New York. And welcome John Upton, who's senior science writer for Climate Central. And welcome to the program, John Upton. Good to have you.
Hey there, Michael. Nice to be with you again.
Yeah, glad to have you again. And I guess first I'd like to talk to you about expectations. All this talk about bold ideas and galvanizing and catalyzing. And there are a lot of leaders there, or some certainly significant ones missing. But what's the sense of expectation? What can come out of this? Is this just a prelude to Paris, or do they think they can get some kind of treaty?
This is really what's happening in New York this week, today at the summit at the United Nations headquarters, is really nothing more than just world leaders have been invited to come along and share their ideas for how they plan to contribute to the fight against climate change. This is not a formal negotiation. It's a bit of a litmus test to see how serious nations are, particularly the influential nations such as the U.S., China, increasingly India. Some of these big countries see how serious they are about actually making efforts to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions, the pollution that they put into the air that's changing the climate. What we're hearing from mostly is the heads of state of small nations, developing nations, poor nations, who are pleading with the rich countries to do more. We're not getting a lot of big announcements here from the big countries. We're hearing a lot more pleading, which is what we've been hearing for years, from the poor countries that are really feeling the effects of climate change through flooding, through storms, but without really contributing very much to the problem.
Yeah, I mentioned that there are some significant absences. The president of China, Xi Jinping, and India's foreign minister are not there. Narendra Modi is not there. And Vladimir Putin and Stephen Harper from Canada. But the president is there, and so is Governor Brown. What kind of role is Jerry Brown going to play in this summit?
Well, Jerry Brown's participating in a couple of roundtable discussions. So a lot of today is taken up with speeches by world leaders or their representatives in, senior government officials. Governor Brown is here. He just signed five new bills yesterday related to climate change. He's here just to talk about a couple of things. One is, carbon trading. California obviously has a very successful now carbon trading program, a cap and trade program. And he's also going to take part in a discussion about how cities can reduce their pollution, their climate-changing pollution.
We're talking to John Upton, senior science writer for Climate Central. What's taken place so far, John? What's been at this point?
Well, we've had a lot of we've had some speeches so far. Al Gore, Leonardo DiCaprio, the UN Ban Ki-moon, the general secretary. They opened the day with some speeches. And since then, we've just been hearing from world leaders from all around the world, really, talking about how important they see climate change as being, and in some instances, making their commitments to reduce carbon emissions. So we're seeing a lot of just a lot of talk at the moment, not a lot of serious pledges.
So the expectations about reducing emissions tied to this conference, or strengthening climate resilience, or for that matter, even mobilizing some political will for something headed toward a legal agreement, expectations along those lines would be inflated.
I think that anybody who expects a lot of substantial movement at this summit will probably be disappointed. This is really, this is a meeting to
You're starting to cut out, John.
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. Listen, I'm glad to have had you here, and I want to express my gratitude for your being with us. Good luck, and we'll hear from you, no doubt, in terms of covering this summit. It is a very important summit, however, by many people's lights, and let me tell you a couple of people we have with us to talk about it and really to talk about climate change, certainly voices that are familiar to many of you who listen to this program. Victor Minotti is here with us. He directs the International Forum on Globalization. Victor, welcome back to Forum.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Also say good morning to Michael Schellenberger, who's here in studio as well. He's president of Breakthrough Institute. It's an energy and innovation think tank. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. And let me begin, Victor, with you, because with all the talk about increasing global cooperation, a lot of and you being the head of an international forum, a lot of your emphasis is on what Congress has to do.
And that's exactly why not much is going to happen in New York. And President Obama is there. He's going to talk about the different administrative actions he's able to take. But we need an act from Congress. We need a national policy to cut emissions that will bind our nation to a global treaty. World leaders are here, but they need us to act. America needs to act. It's up to us. There's an election happening in just a few weeks. The financial and ideological leaders of this opposition to phasing out fossil fuels, I'm talking about Charles and David Koch, the world's two wealthiest men, they are six seats away from taking our Senate and having the entire Congress in the United States. They're running people on planks to eliminate the EPA, to pass the Keystone Pipeline. I'm really afraid of what this world will be like and trying to deal with a climate crisis under a Koch Congress.
Well, there are people like Tom Steyer who are giving them a run for their money and battling in many organizations as well. But I wonder why you put so much emphasis on the Koch brothers and Congress when the biggest emitter of CO2, for example, is China.
Not historical, Michael. Not historical. China, because we have helped to rapidly industrialize them over the past decade, has gone through the roof as anticipated, as predicted. But historically, throughout the industrial revolution, it's the United States that's still the biggest. The world is waiting for us to act. Again, if I didn't make it clear why we're so focused on the U.S. is because there is no global treaty, because the world is waiting for us to act. Other countries are acting. China is doing way more in terms of public investment, installation of solar, mobilizing different public resources to shut down coal and to bring in renewables. It's us who needs to act. And so that's why our focus on what's happening domestically, so we can unblock a global process that needs to move quickly. Paris is at the end of 2015, and Americans need to know it's up to us to deliver our government to a deal there.
Well, let me ask you, since you put the emphasis on Congress, what about the leadership of President Obama? I mean, he's given a lot of rhetoric, as he does.
It hasn't been
great.
He's doing some things that he can do. He could stop the Keystone Pipeline right now. But he's got all these other administrative things that with his powers he's trying to assert through the EPA, and Koch and the Tea Party are trying to shut him down. And I'll distinguish right here, Michael. It's we see a separation in the fossil fuels industry between the Koch heads and the other parts of industry and even the fossil fuels industry. You have Exxon and Chevron who have talked about carbon taxes. The statement today by business leaders, they're talking about putting a price on carbon. If you look at the opposition, it's fewer and fewer characters, but they're more and more powerful because of the political rules that we have.
Let me bring Michael Schellenberger into this. Michael, you see things similarly on the domestic front, that we have to lead the way here?
Well, I mean, obviously, as an American, I want to see us taking strong leadership. I mean, it is a little bit like we've seen this movie before. I mean, in some ways, you must have had like one of these conversations at least once a year for the last 20, 25 years. I mean, what's changed today is that just 7 years ago when our book came out, the U.S. and China were tied as the world's biggest emitters. Today, China is 28% of global emissions and the United States is 14%. I mean, the world has changed dramatically. Now, in terms of the United States, few people even realize it, but our emissions have declined faster than any other countries in the world over the last 5 years. So since 2007 and controlling for the recession, our emissions declined very significantly. Coal went from 50% of our electricity mix to 38%, and natural gas went from about 30% to 40%. Now, most people that care about climate change see this as a bad thing because they don't like fracking for natural gas. But it's this abundance of huge quantities of natural gas in the United States that's been driving down U.S. emissions. China's now racing to get its shale fracking up and running. There's a discussion in the U.K. about doing it. And, of course, there's been a total change of mind among many environmentalists, including myself, around nuclear energy. So you see nuclear energy back again on the table. United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change included a big role for nuclear in its last report earlier this year. You see major figures, Stuart Brand, Jeff Sachs just came out with a huge proposal where he says, look, if you want to try to meet 450 parts per million to stabilize carbon emissions, you've got to have a lot of nuclear power. There's just no way that you're going to significantly reduce fossil energy consumption with solar panels and wind turbines. Now, solar's been growing fast. But last year, it grew from 0.15% to 0.23%. And that's after basically subsidizing half to two-thirds the cost of every solar system. That's the, you know, both ratepayer and taxpayer subsidies. So what's happening is you still have the same dynamics that we've always had on climate. Poor countries, they need cheap energy to develop. You have 2 billion people that still rely on wood and dung. Huge part of them are in Africa. They need reliable baseload power. They're mostly going to get it from hydroelectric dams and natural gas. But really, around the world, the focus of global leaders ought to be on the thing that matters most, and that's making low-carbon alternatives cheap. And whether that's solar or nuclear or wind or geothermal, the focus of international leaders needs to be on technological innovation. Energy transitions happen when cheaper and cleaner and better technologies replace older ones. And we have something to do with that process.
You know, of course, a lot of people recoil when they hear natural gas because they do think of fracking, or when they hear nuclear because they think, of course, of nuclear waste.
Sure. I mean, you know, and there are environmental consequences to every energy source. So it's a question of what environmental consequences do you want? With natural gas, you get half the carbon emissions of coal. We did a report called Coal Killer. We looked at every scientific peer-reviewed study of the environmental and human impacts of gas compared to coal, and gas wins every time. Fewer deaths from natural gas than coal, less water pollution from natural gas than coal, and that's what it's replacing. It's replacing coal.
This is called embrace low emissions. I think
it's called harm reduction, is what it gets called in the drug policy context.
But what about fracking? I mean, you know, even Governor Brown has said sort of the verdict is out on it, but there are many environmentalists, and I know you look at some of them as maybe not being pragmatic enough, but you know, not really recognizing perhaps the dangers of fracking, particularly things like groundwater.
Well, first of all, let's actually talk about groundwater. So you have problems of wastewater disposal that you have with all energy production. Again, compared to coal, natural gas is far better. Fracking does not contaminate groundwater. There's not a single instance of it. There was one case that was looked at in Wyoming. EPA now says it was not a case of groundwater contamination by fracking. So again, you have wastewater disposal. You have a lot of water that gets used in fracking. It's a big concern in the West and the drought. These are all problems that can be managed through good regulation, good behavior by firms. I mean, look, even on the methane leakage, which is the most significant question, I think, because methane is such a strong greenhouse gas, you've had natural gas production in the United States increase by 40% since 1990, and you've had methane leakage decline during that same period by 10%. Why is that? That's according to the EPA, by the way, and the National Academy of Sciences has confirmed it. Why is that? Well, the leakage you get from natural gas wells are from the older wells. So the gas, the leakage doesn't come from the fracking. It comes from not sealing the wells properly. So in the movie Gasland, that famous scene where he lights his faucet on the water on fire, that's from an old well leaking from decades ago. And it was in New York State, where they don't allow fracking in shale. So no energy is perfect, but if you have to choose between coal and gas, and we do, then you go with natural gas. In my view, it's a mistake to shut down our nuclear plants, as the environmental movement in California wants to do, and move back to gas. I think if the choice is between natural gas and nuclear, we should go with nuclear because it's zero carbon.
I know Victor's going to want to weigh in here, but before we go to Victor here, I want to get your take, Michael, on something that's become even a bigger issue in recent weeks, really, because of the release of a book by Naomi Klein, where essentially she takes the argument that it's a capitalist system that's really leading us into this carbon nightmare and the possibility of catastrophe because of climate change. I mean, you know, I'm obviously being kind of crystallizing and relating what she has here, but she says that market forces are making it worse and that what we have to do is do away with this notion that the free market is going to save us all and that capitalism is the answer. In fact, we have to build another system into it.
I mean, there's part of her critique that we I really agree with. I mean, first of all, I don't even know that I would call our current system capitalist in the sense that 40% of the economy is government. Every major energy technology that we have, including natural gas, nuclear, solar, wind, all depended heavily on government research and development investments. Over decades, it requires major government efforts. So I appreciate what Naomi is saying, which is saying that governments have a really important role to invest in making clean energy cheap. What I don't agree with is this idea that we have to change everything and how we live and we have to do everything differently. It is grandiose, and frankly, it just doesn't have anything to do with reducing emissions. I mean, this idea that we had to change, radically change how we live our lives and move to radical reductions in energy consumption, it dates back to 1962. Murray Bookchin, Barry Commoner.
People I interviewed back in the day, but you know, making me almost nostalgic here. One thing I was struck by, thousands of people protesting, of course, before this climate summit, is a lot of them... you know, we're fairly privileged people that are coming in on private jets. The mess afterward, the New York papers have written about this, the mess that was left just environmentally in terms of being a little bit more sanctified toward what you're doing in terms of refuse and debris and all of that sort of thing was really appalling. I mean, these are people who are supposedly dedicated to environmental change and want to do something in terms of the carbon footprint.
I mean, I think the most appalling thing, Michael, is I just feel like the left and progressives and liberals in general, we just have forgotten that energy, modern energy, not using wood and dung to heat and cook your food, as 2 billion people in the world do. Modern energy liberates us. Electricity takes the smoke out of the home. 4 million people die a year of indoor air pollution. And it's sort of like we forget about those people in this race to just make it all about renewables and climate. Look, we've got to have energy transitions. Every time we make one, we go to cleaner sources of energy. We've got to accelerate those transitions through government, public-private partnerships to make clean energy cheap. It doesn't require everybody moving back and becoming organic farmers or trying to live on one-tenth of our energy. It requires changing how we produce electricity and the fuels for transportation.
Again, Michael Schellenberger is president of Breakthrough Institute. Victor Minotti is director of the International Forum on Globalization. Victor, you're going to have to weigh in here, especially on nuclear and fracking.
I brought a copy of a report for both of you, which we put out not long ago called Nuclear Roulette. And listeners can see it on IFG.org. It's called Nuclear Roulette.
I'm taking it in my hands here, yeah.
Nuclear power. So I won't engage in all the details. I mean, and broadly, I'll refer
again,
you
names,
to—
names that are very recognizable, Gar Smith, Ernie Kallenbach.
Yeah. We saw that the comprehensive case had never been made against nuclear energy. So there you have it. Refer folks to it. And I'll say more broadly, you know, I'm reminded in this discussion about my first boss, Dennis Hayes, who, you know, President Jimmy Carter appointed as National Renewable Energy Laboratory Chief. And he told us when I worked at Earth Day that the big challenge is not technological, it's political. That we will figure out ways to get or to build the right technologies. What matters is the policy change and building the political power to get those right rules into place. So is it going to be rules that are you know, going to eliminate carbon emissions while we increase methane gas, or is it going to account for you know, waste of you know, from nuclear energy? All those things are on the table right now. But the big question of this country cutting its carbon emissions, that discussion is blocked. And so
criticism we're hearing from Michael, which is criticism of the left?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that there's been really a failure to recognize some of the things that can do a lot more to ameliorate the problem that we have with carbon.
Well, there's a ton more we can do, but the big things that we need to do.
But that the left, in many ways, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that's what you're saying, isn't it? That the left has held things up.
I mean, we did an analysis that found from 1950 to today, natural gas and nuclear have avoided 32 times more carbon emissions than solar and wind combined. I mean, why the opposition to natural gas and nuclear is not coming from the right. It's not coming from climate skeptics.
Well, now, wait a second. Let me go back to Victor's point here, because when he makes it into political or domestic politics, the recent Pew poll, which probably both of you know about, 68% of Democrats were asked about the seriousness with which they attach to climate change. And 68%, yes, it's very serious and a major threat. Only 25% of Republicans felt the same way. We do have a partisan divide here. There's no question about it. If almost 70% say this is a major threat and only a quarter say it's not a major threat.
Yes, but Michael, if you go deeper into that in that poll, what I saw is that conservatives and Republicans are not—they're divided on the science also. They may not rank it as high as Democrats might, but it's not that they don't think it's a problem necessarily. And again, the point I'm trying to make here is you have to look at the divide. There is—I'm not dismissing the divide. I'm saying there is a divide, and we have to figure out— the advocates of different technologies and all the different approaches, we need some coordinated political approach to really isolate the few folks that are blocking things here. I think a lot of leaders in our movement, we talk about big oil still. We got to take on big oil. Well, break down big oil. And what we found is that the Kochs outspent all the other oil companies, even Exxon, when it comes to campaign contributions, direct lobbying expenditures, climate denial science, lobbying for the Keystone XL pipeline, all these different things. They have so much wealth and power. They've sort of personally taken on to be the main front
of
the
fossil fuels lobby.
We may not
have pure capitalism, as Michael says, but this is, the Koch brothers are about as close as you get to just profit in its own sake and wanting a free market and everything. Is Naomi Klein on the right track here then?
I think Naomi Klein is, putting her finger on a big part of the problem. And the Koch brothers, if you look at the ideology that they're advancing, they call it economic freedom. You can check out economicfreedom.org. And it is ultra-capitalism. They see themselves as really making the moral case, especially after the financial collapse, they're trying to uphold the system and advance those principles and ideals. And they've bought, not just a radical faction of the Republican Party, but now I think they've pretty much captured the GOP.
So is that our main obstacle here, as you see things, Michael Schellenberger?
No. Look, for a lot of conservatives, they see this issue and they hear people say global warming is going to destroy civilization unless we radically change how we live our lives.
Michael, but those conservatives are not elected officials.
May I finish? Kind of finish my point, though. So, a lot of conservatives, they hear climate activists say global warming is going to destroy human civilization unless we radically change how we live our lives. And then reasonable people go, okay, well, maybe we should transition from coal to natural gas, which has less carbon, and to nuclear. And the same climate activists go, oh, no, we can't do that. Well, why not? Well, because we have to move to a society that uses radically less energy and thus able to use renewables only. And I think a lot of conservatives go, well, then I thought we were talking about reducing emissions, but you just changed this to moving to the kind of Murray Bookchin, Barry Common, or Naomi Klein type society where more people are farming
so
and
unfair.
Doing small scale. What is unfair? Did you read Naomi Klein's book?
Saying that. No, I just came out. I haven't read it yet. Neither have you.
I have actually spent a fair amount of time with it, and that's exactly what the argument is. In other words,
you're
every major—
You're casting unfairly a lot
okay,
of
well,
your
let me
colleagues.
Ask you this.
I'm going to have to be a referee here because we're coming up on a break. It's lively, but let me do this. Let me give out the phone number because I want to invite listeners to join this conversation. And we clearly have a serious debate going on here, and I'd like to hear from you on this. And you can join us by phone. Our toll-free number is available right now, 866-733-6786. Again, that's toll-free for your calls, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQED Forum. Many ways to communicate, and we would like to hear from you. So join the program. Talking with Michael Schellenberger, president of the Breakthrough Institute, Victor Minotti, director of the International Forum on Globalization, and I'm Michael Krasny. Well, that's from a protest that took place on Sunday in Oakland. There were 4,000 marching, in fact, and you can hear them talking about not wanting Well, not wanting Obama, to provide leadership, which is what we're hearing from Victor Minotti here. And those protests, by the way, went all across the globe. There were even many more in New York. And Victor Minotti is here with us in studio. He's director of the International Forum on Globalization. Michael Schellenberger is president of the Breakthrough Institute, which is an energy and innovation think tank. And they used to be allies. I guess they still are to a degree, but there are some serious differences.
We're fighting the same fight.
Yeah.
We're fighting the same fight. One thing I wanted to point out, Michael, about what's going on in New York that's new and that's exciting, that's great for this movement, is the not just the presence but the leadership of frontline communities who are fighting fossil fuel extraction, you know, in Alberta, around the country, fence line communities who live next to the polluting facilities, you know, communities of color, poor people. There's a real strong presence, and I think if you look at things like the Our Power campaign, .org. People can see some of the demands that these groups are bringing forth about community-based solutions for community-owned energy, and it's really exciting stuff. I think you see it going out on in Richmond here to try to replace the Chevron and other fossil fuels energy production. You know, there is a vision that's coming out of these communities about how they will control power and how it needs to be done.
Now, this kind of grassroots thing is always encouraging. I just wish they'd clean up more of them after themselves. I'm sorry to be that.
That's a terrible sight to see. You know, 400,000 people.
It was a terrible sight to see. I mean, afterward, in terms of, it's a great sight, you know, if you're in favor of what they're doing. But when the mess is there, it's distressing. Merrily writes, I was surprised to hear you say, what about China? They are the biggest. We Americans are the worst polluters per capita by orders of magnitude. It is we who must change our lifestyles to be more in tune with the needs of the climate. We must lead the way in order for the nations who are trying to live like the Americans do to change their trajectory too. But you heard Michael Schellenberger talk about these figures where China is now twice the carbon producer that we are. And yet you're saying also, are you not, Victor?
But if you look at the numbers of historical emissions is what the United Nations process is going by and trying to do. There's a thing in The Guardian UK today that people can look at different responsibilities of different nations that they've measured over time.
And you were talking, Michael, about, you know, maybe too much emphasis put on the wrong sorts of things. But I wonder what your response is. And we're going to go to our callers. To a listener who writes, a concrete step to combat global climate change would be for the United States to increase its gas tax to the same levels as in Europe. Even in San Francisco, I see far too many outsized SUVs on the streets.
Sure. I mean, it'd be great to, I mean, I think it's always fine to, like, you know, modestly increase the prices, you know, modestly, is because that's what the public would tolerate on fossil energy. But the main event is making clean energy cheap. In other words, if you want to replace oil, your focus ought to be on making electric cars, fuel cell cars, cheaper and better than today's internal combustion engines. That's how we're going to replace internal combustion engines. And to Obama's credit, he did a stimulus package which invested heavily in Tesla, invested heavily in a whole set of other alternative energy of technologies. I mean, I would just point out, look, China, and you know, I think everybody's correct. I mean, U.S. has much bigger emissions per capita than China still, and Victor's right. Historical emissions have been mostly have been overwhelmingly from developed countries. That's why we're developed. But 75% of new emissions over the next century are going to come from the developing world. And so if we would like for that number to go down and for there to be fewer emissions, then our focus has got to be on technological innovation. And here, there's some good news to report. I mean, the U.S. has been helping China both to develop its natural gas resources. They're using fracking technologies developed here in the United States. They're also developing advanced nuclear, including better reactor types that have a different kind of coolant that make them much safer, that were actually developed in Oak Ridge and other U.S. laboratories. We basically just gave them to the Chinese. They're developing them. And to the extent that which China is actually taking significant action on climate, it's by deploying these low-carbon technologies. Now, the interesting thing is China is doing so mostly for conventional environmental reasons. Beijing is obviously hard to live in now. It's so polluted. And so for that reason, China is investing heavily in moving towards cleaner sources of energy. But again, it's still not enough. And if the international community, international leaders would like to do more on climate, they've got to move away from this model of just continuing to make promises after promises, which is what they've been doing for the last 20 years, and get focused on technological collaborations to make clean energy cheap. That's the main event. That's what matters most.
And the drive behind that would be presumably profit, not only, of course, saving the planet, but so that gives, well, less force, perhaps, to Naomi Klein's argument?
Yeah, I mean, I think she, you know, there's, again, like I said, I think there's a shared collective interest. Governments have a shared interest in having energy that's cheaper and cleaner. In other words, when we develop, when you develop advanced solar, advanced nuclear, cheap and clean natural gas, those technologies spill over all around the world. They're very difficult to patent, and everybody gets to benefit from them. So I think that you get into a dynamic when you're making shared investments in technological innovation. That's a win-win dynamic rather than the dynamic that the United Nations has been caught in for the last 20 years, which is sort of this, you go first, you sacrifice first, you pay more, and then I'll come along later.
It's also not fair in many respects. You think of these developing nations, there's a subtext always that you've had your way, you've moved into economic prosperity and so forth. Now it's our turn. You've been polluting. Well, if we have to pollute, so be it. I just want to read some online comments and emails. Rose writes, hoping you will note that Jerry Brown can't truly lead on climate while he allows fracking in California. Another listener writes, so long as nuclear power companies by law owe their sole allegiance to their shareholders and use their profits to lobby to no regulation, I quite frankly don't trust the system to keep us safe. And another listener says, how do you expect U.S. policymakers to speak up for climate change when 1 in 4 Americans is skeptical that climate change is real and caused by humans? Well, let me go to our callers, and we'll begin, Frank, with you. Good morning, Frank.
Good morning. I'd like to, I guess the polite way to say this, challenge Mr. Menotti's idea that the only thing we need to do is create a political will for change. I would suggest that the way to do that requires individual actors, i.e. citizens, to want to adopt the program, and I don't hear him articulating a coherent program in terms of what is the mix of energy. Does he actually believe that renewables can take up the slack from big oil? Because if he does, then I think he's crazy. But not my opinion. What's your opinion? Give me a program that I'm supposed to vote for. Tell me how you want my life to change and how you want the society to change. Is it Naomi Klein or is it something in the middle? Your opponent has a very clear program that I'm listening to and going, okay, I can buy into that.
All right, Frank, let me interrupt because you're asking a direct question to Victor. I'd like him to respond. Victor?
Yeah, I don't think you could fairly cast me saying that. That was what Michael was saying, and I corrected him during the break that I think people get the perception that it's just about renewables, and if you don't talk about efficiency, if you don't talk about cutting overall energy reduction use, if you don't talk about trade rules, if you don't talk about, you know, carbon pricing and carbon taxes, then it doesn't add up to anything. The mix of fuels that I think you know we would advocate are, I think, best articulated in a report we did called Waiting for a Miracle that looks at that there's no possible mix of all the different renewable and efficiency things, technologies that you have out there that don't also that aren't able to produce enough energy without radical reductions of energy use. We did this with the Post Carbon Institute, and you can look at our website, ifg.org. where it goes through technology by technology with scientific committees about what the capacity is of each technology to produce energy, you know, and then what it adds up to is just it's not enough. So, I mean, Michael is correct on that, but we always talk about, you know, not necessarily adding on nuclear or fracking, but instead really looking where you can reduce overall energy use and energy consumption through redesign of economies, through reduction of long distance trade, you know, and basically stop, you know, it's a redesign of the economy. And I think in that sense that I would weigh much more in with Naomi Klein, as this requires a redesign of our economic system that doesn't, you know, the logic is to externalize all the ecological costs. And what we need is a system that is guided where any sort of growth actually includes the ecological costs and the social costs. And there are all sorts of groups around the world who are articulating this vision. I just gave you one because I think the communities of color who have taken their demands to New York, you know, it's a vision that we definitely support.
There's something else, and let me thank the caller. And then that was a question for Victor. I want to go to a caller who has a question for you, Michael. But one of the encouraging things I think that has to be mentioned about this summit is they have not only government leaders, they have some business and finance people. I mean, they've invited to the United Nations civil and social leaders and so forth. I mean, there's a I think if you're going to come to some kind of real resolution and move forward, you really need to. This is what the Dutch did, for example, and they did to a great degree. They brought in business people, they brought in environmentalists, and they brought in, you know, people who had all kinds of different interests and tried to find common ground. I'm going to go to Berkeley next. Harvey, you're on.
Hello, Michael, and thank you to your guests. About the carbon lie that it produces no about the nuclear lie that it produces no carbon, and I'm not even talking about the mining, refining, transportation, storage, guarding, building, and decommissioning of nuclear plants, which produce a tremendous amount of carbon. I'm talking about something that no one ever talks about. It turns out that many of the nuclear power plants are grid-powered, including the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant. And it turns out that the grid in California, over 51% is, most of it is natural gas-fired, then there's oil-fired, and then out-of-state coal-fired plants produce about 51% of the electricity used in California. And here you have the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant pumping 2.5 billion, that's with a B, gallons of water every day, plus running the plant, plus the spent fuel pools, keeping all that cool. We're talking about a tremendous amount of electricity. That plant's been in operation for about 25 years. That's 25 years of pumping 2.5 billion gallons every day using grid power. And the grid is over 51% produced by greenhouse gas and fossil fuels. So how could they say that nuclear is carbon free? That's the biggest lie on the planet today.
We'll hear from Michael Schellenberger. Michael?
Well, that's not right. Nuclear is very low carbon. Yes, there's some trace carbon in the manufacturing of the plants and in other aspects of the operation, but it is one of the lowest carbon energy sources. Diablo Canyon produces power for about 3 million homes in California. Diablo Canyon does not use more energy than it produces. It produces huge quantities of electricity. That's what's whether you like it or hate it, that's what's amazing about nuclear is that you can produce a huge quantity of energy in a very small space. So it has the smallest land footprint of any energy technology. So if you love the natural environment, I mean, look at Diablo Canyon. You know, it's just this tiny plant surrounded by oak fields, and it's got all sorts of sea life around it. And again, don't take my word for it. Just go and pay attention to the science of nuclear. You can also go to the Breakthrough Institute's website. We have a frequently asked questions on nuclear.
You always look at France and the sure. clean energy in France, but then you look at Fukushima in Japan, you know what I mean? And those are sort of, for me, the two sides.
I went to Fukushima earlier this year. I mean, it's a bad industrial accident. Japan, like France, does not have indigenous fossil energy reserves. They needed to produce their own energy. It was a terrible accident. And at the same time, 18,000 people were instantly killed in a tsunami that killed people in all sorts of technological environments. And Fukushima had levels of damage that are basically unmeasurable. I mean, the scientific calculations on it are that's extremely hard to calculate any number of people that will get cancer or die from the radioactive releases because they were so low and so minor. So
we're getting emails right on and tweets right on topic here. In fact, I'm going to go to a caller in a moment, but just a listener email that writes, we've had the technology to separate water into hydrogen and oxygen for a couple decades now. Why not create a power plant on one of the Great Lakes to beta test a hydrogen plant that emits oxygen as a byproduct? Once Southern California perfects desalination, we can hook that up to it and replace all our nuclear plants with hydrogen, scale it down, stick it on a Tesla and oil companies, and they can get into the water purification business. Here's a tweet from a listener, and this always comes up in these discussions. Nuclear must examine use of thorium, new reactor designs, and smaller power distribution grids.
Yeah. Can I just add one quick thing on that? So hydrogen's not an energy source. Hydrogen is a fuel. It has to be created. So one of the early visions of the thorium people are wonderful. They're very passionate. One of the inventors of that, Alvin Weinberg, who was at Oak Ridge Labs in the 50s and 60s, we just did a really great story. We published a story about him. He was very concerned about climate change, actually, in the 60s. And these nuclear engineers, people don't realize it, they were early environmentalists. They believed that we should have large nuclear plants that exactly, as the caller said, would produce hydrogen so that we could power our entire vehicle fleet on hydrogen fuels and have all of our electricity coming from very low carbon nuclear energy. I mean, that was the big environmental vision. It was decoupling, allowing for human development.
Back then, it's Jeremy Rifkin's dream, you know?
Yeah, human development, allowing human development to continue while radically reducing the human footprint on the environment and radically reducing our emissions.
Let me get another caller on, and that's you, Peter. You're on. Good morning.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. Great program. 24 hours ago, I stood on First Avenue and 45th Street watching the delegates streaming into the United Nations, and I had this bad premonition that these folks aren't going to be able to accomplish anything because there's one thing missing from their negotiations, and that is there's no price on carbon emissions. And the day before, at the march with 400,000 people, which was awesome, there were a couple of very notable things. For one, people are not calling very much for a price on carbon emissions the way Citizens Climate Lobby is, which I'm a member of. And two, they're really anti-nuclear, which I used to be, but I'm not anymore. My question is, why are people not getting the message that we cannot solve this problem as long as carbon pollution is free or almost free? So we need a revenue-neutral carbon fee and dividend that protects households so we can ramp it up steeply. And two, with Jim Hansen and his colleagues calling for more nuclear, why are so few people educated about the fourth generation, the next generation, the new generation of nukes that, from what I've been told, can't blow up, can't melt down, don't produce bombs, and eat the waste?
Yeah, the Citizens Climate Lobby has been a really good group in advancing putting a price on carbon, a carbon tax. And I would suggest people look at their website, Citizens Climate Lobby. It's a real grassroots, volunteer-based lobby in key districts around the country, and we need to support
them. And it's an idea whose time has definitely come, one would think. But what about the nuclear, which he brings up here again?
I think we spent enough time in the show talking about nuclear roulette, and I really want to talk about the what we need for a global deal. And that is not, you know, the technology is part of the solution, but it is not the solution. You know, I go back to the Dennis Hayes thing. It's like to have these policies in place where we're actually going to move innovation and get these technologies deployed, a carbon price is a big part of that. You know, Michael, the all the different programs that the Obama administration and others are investing in for different technologies and renewable fuel cells and electric cars and infrastructure and so on, Koch is killing that stuff because they have control of the budget now. If they get this Senate, it's goodbye clean energy financing from the public sector. And so what I would like to shift the focus of the discussion and the movement's attention to, yes, technology is it's going to be part of it, but it's not where the fight really is and where the movement energy needs to go.
One very quick
point. I'll finish on just his last comment on technology by also referring people to our website, ifg.org. Because next month in October, we are having a very important teach-in on techno-utopia and the fate of the Earth, precisely because of the discussion here that all the blind faith that technology is going to cure this problem for us, not just climate, but the ecological crisis. You know, and a lot of the solutions that are there are based in communities. They have distributed ownership, distributed energy production. And I think there is a different approach here that, you know, it's an important debate within the movement about which kinds of technologies are we going to support. So this is a really important event with a lot of, you know, critics of technology. We'll be talking about the mega technologies of energy production and so on. And so ifg.org, you could see that for that full program.
Okay. Michael Schellenberger, you had something you wanted
to add.
Just
a quick point is that first of all, I appreciate the caller. He's right. James Hansen and other climate scientists have been wonderful in making clear that you can't solve climate change without a lot of nuclear energy. And I would just point out, look, France and Sweden were the two countries that most rapidly reduced the carbon intensity of their economies, and they did so by scaling up nuclear. They did not have a price on carbon. So the idea that you have to have a price on carbon is just not true. You can just move to cleaner sources of energy.
All right, we'll move to another caller, and it's Scott who joins us from Palo Alto. Scott, welcome. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning, guys. I've got kind of a big question for you. If you were, imagine yourself as JFK standing up there and saying that we're going to go to the moon just because we can, and then have a large segment of the economy and innovation kind of realign itself around that endeavor, And it's really just the United States that was going to the moon. They didn't really care about anybody else. And I know that this is not the ideal. But
whoa, wait a minute. I think they cared about the Soviet Union a great deal. Well, remember the name Yuri Gagarin? He was a cosmonaut.
That's fine. Let's let competition play its part then. But let's pretend like you had $4 trillion, like, for example, like we did. We're clearly willing to go to war for $4 trillion. And we were willing to take that money from our offspring and our great-grandchildren and whatnot. What would you do as president? What would be your boldest move as a true leader of the United States? And what would you do with $4 trillion? And I'm not saying sinking into one target, but just to give me I'm just an ordinary citizen. Give me your selling point with $4 trillion. I appreciate it.
And is that figure, may I ask you, Scott, perhaps not so coincidentally linked to the amount of money we spent in the Iraq War?
Yeah, it definitely is. You know, I would say that, hell, we spent $4 trillion, and let's say we are even willing to lose thousands of lives in the endeavor, because we're clearly willing to do that for war. What would that mean to you? And instead of creating a system, instead of creating some kind of economic system, why don't we create an event and let the economic system coalesce around that? What would be your gamble?
Let me take the spirit of your call, because this whole UN summit, which you're talking about, was pretty much engineered to provide bold ideas. I mean, he used the word bold, too. Yeah. So you have all the money you can to spend, and we'll look at it from a triage point of view. What would be top priority?
Yeah, well, I mean, let me take it more pragmatically. I mean, I would just say, you know, 10 years ago, we advocated for a $300 billion investment in energy innovation. Obama did about $150 billion as part of the stimulus and part of some other legislation. That same approach applies, but it's got to be technology neutral. It should not be dogmatic. It should not insist that it all be solar or that it all be nuclear, but it should be a big investment in these technologies sustained over a long period of time. So I think that Obama, the Chinese, the Europeans should come together with some agreement to very significantly increase our investment in energy innovation across these technologies, increase collaboration, allow for more of the technological secrets to spill over between borders in the acknowledgement that we have more to gain by working together than by competition. In this case, I just think really, you know, everyone talks about how do you get 180-some countries to agree. Forget about it. You just got to get China, the United States, and the EU and India. You could even add the other top 10 economies in the world to make an agreement to basically increase how much we spend on energy innovation 5 to 10-fold. I think that's something that countries can do and would see in their self-interest. So it's not just, I think, a big vision. I also think it's a pragmatic one.
Yeah, Victor Minotti, agree with all that?
Well, I wasn't listening. I was thinking more about the question and the $4 trillion. I mean, it's a lot of money to spend, and I don't know if it really, especially focused in the U.S., and, you know, not wanting bigger government myself, you could do it for much less than that, and you could reduce the cost even more by putting a price on carbon and offsetting that to help pay for some of the expenses, some of the higher costs that you would have. Going back to the idea of one of the callers, Citizens Climate Lobby, it's sort of based on that. But where that money needs to be deployed is what the big fight will be about. Now, certainly some of a lot of it needs to go to
stimulate. Let me just ask you back up for a moment, though, to something Michael was emphasizing, I think, and I'm going to put words in your mouth here, Michael, was really look at innovation across borders and cooperative on a global level, but also not just a portfolio that's limited to renewables. Go the portfolio the whole hog in terms of what you can do with energy.
Well, that's
including nuclear,
one of the parts about the question, because he wanted a limit to the U.S., and I don't think you can. So you definitely need the international cooperation on this. So, you know, what the U.S. does has to help leverage and inform and finance, in fact. That's part of our global treaty negotiations or under the U.N. framework on climate change is to provide technology and finance.
But he was talking about
countries.
Global agreement, and that's really, I think, that's at least what presumably is going to be an attempt to be brought to fruition at the UN meeting.
Not at this one.
No, I mean the one preparing for Paris.
In Paris.
Yeah, in 2015. Well,
that's 2015. In 2010, IFG and a lot of our colleagues were part of creating within the UN
Ban Ki-moon said there's no plan B, in fact. He was pretty clear on that.
About what comes out of this.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of the infrastructure that we've built to help transfer finance and technology to the developing countries who want it, who need it. They're asking for it, but we haven't financed it. That's one of the, that's where a lot of the $4 trillion or whatever number we're working with there would certainly have to go. Within the U.S., it has to go to make the renewables cheaper and to bring efficiency in and finance a lot of the innovations, both with, you know, public transport to retrofitting buildings. There's so many different areas that need to be financed and are under-sourced right now. So there's a ton of opportunities, and that's how we would distribute the money.
Well, we've got a ton of callers here. Let me go to another one. And Bell, that's you. Welcome. You're on the air. Good morning.
Yes. Hi, good morning. I'm changing the subject slightly from energy consumption to a topic that is so rarely discussed, and that is the huge impact of animal agriculture on climate change. And I urge everyone to either see the documentary called Cowspiracy, or look at the book Comfortably Unaware. That book, those two sources have so much information, and we could all make a difference starting today.
Okay. We thank you, Bell, for that comment. We'll let it stand, and we'll go to another caller, and that's a caller from Burbank. GS, good morning. Do we have GS on the line here?
Oh, I beg your pardon. So sorry. My comment was basically as to moving to like a thorium reactor for nuclear stuff. Sure, a good idea, but that's not likely to contribute in terms of energy till about 2030 or so. And although I realize that the waste products of nuclear fission are not directly related to climate change, there's an unbelievable amount of radioactive waste all over the place on this planet. There's no central repository. That's my comment. Thank you.
Okay. We thank you for the comment. And here's Rick, who writes, I wonder what the left would propose as a solution. China and India have not agreed to limit their carbon usage, and America has to a great deal. What realistic limits can America put into place to make any measurable effect on the global carbon footprint? One could imagine us all working at home, no travel allowed, and even this might not be enough to make the slightest difference.
It's not the case. The U.S. has no national policy to cut its emissions. It's what we need. China does have a energy intensity target that's related to carbon reductions and much more robust financing. So it's up to us. It's up to America to make this change.
Seconds left. Vic, Michael, get a final word from you. Michael Schellenberger.
Yeah, let's focus on the stuff that works, that's always worked. That's been technological innovation. That's been international collaboration. And I think really rethinking some of our own prejudices against some of the technologies that we're going to need.
Well, we will keep our eyes on the summit. We will keep you informed. Thanks to Michael Schellenberger of the Breakthrough Institute and Victor Minotti of the International Forum on Globalization. Good, gentlemanly, and vigorous debate we've had here. Thank you both. And we're coming up in another hour. We're going to look at back 50 years ago, the free speech movement, and what it's all wrought, what it's all brought to bear. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.